Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond here for the next hour. And good morning, Tom. How are you doing?
Hey, not too shabby. How about you this fine day?
Drier than expected. That was a little bit of a downpour there. I think we need to do our standard let's complain about the weather segment as we do every Saturday.
We're Minnesotans. It's mandatory.
Yeah, well, we had a nice week, and is it too much to ask for one Saturday that's dry and warm and sunny?
I'm going to say yes.
Yeah, it is. Excellent.
You are a greedy man.
I am a very greedy person, but we'll try to make do with what it is. We are dry right now, and it is the Rivertown Art Fair today.
That's right. I actually managed to get down there right before the show, take a little walk around.
A lot of people are not bothered by the elements of our Minnesota weather, so it's good to see people out there. Encourage people to come out and check it out. There are still some parking spots, because I think everyone here found a place to park.
I'm not a huge art person myself when it comes to the stuff they have, but they have lots of mini donuts, that I am a fan of.
Radio is art, and we're going to create art here the next hour. Speaking of art, well, artists, doctors, Dr. Joyce Brothers, famed TV psychologist, dies at 85. Dr. Joyce Brothers, a psychologist who became a pop culture fixture after she turned to radio and television in the late 50s, to tend to the nation's psyche, has died. She was 85 years old. Do you know who Dr. Joyce Brothers is?
I absolutely do. She was also very controversial, from my understanding.
In what respect?
Well, some people didn't exactly think that she was deserved to be a doctor, but she was a very smart woman.
When Brothers' psychological expertise was first showcased on NBC in 1958, she paved the way for others in her field to bring their talents to television, according to the Paley Center for Media Study in New York, which, by the way, is a great museum if you're in New York. They have tons of tapes, tons of video, much like our very own tcmedianow.com. Enough self-promotion.
You can never have too much of that.
No. Aided by an engaging on-screen presence, she could publicly address without offending listeners what were then borderline taboo subjects such as fulfillment and infidelity. It was a jarring, significant achievement in the 50s and 60s when television's fictional couples were still portrayed as sleeping in separate beds. You know, because Mike and, or not the Bradys, but I'm thinking like the Beaver family.
I'm thinking Dick Van Dyke.
Dick Van Dyke, yeah, they had twin beds. And Dr. Joyce Brothers, she became a TV psychologist. So I guess you could make the argument that maybe we shouldn't take as much, you have to take it for what it is. She was a fixture on TV, did a lot of guest spots. I was looking up some video today, and Happy Days and Conan O'Brien and Married to the Children. Nothing really appropriate for radio that I could find for our segment here. Because she might have talked about some topics which were a little bit uncomfortable for those.
Risque.
And I think she had kind of that, toward the latter part of her life, she would say maybe some wacky things for a woman of her age and her stature. But I found this commercial, which I think is her last TV appearance in the last few years, and I want to play this. And not to make fun of the product she's selling, but just maybe you come from the 50s, you're a doctor, you've done all these great things on TV, and this is kind of what you've been doing.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joyce Brothers. Those of us who are independent and live alone shouldn't do so without having emergency protection. And for reliability and peace of mind, I recommend the Alert USA Emergency Response System, designed to protect you and your home.
With Alert USA, simply wear our pendant in and around your...
It's good to see she was working till the end.
Yeah, I think this video is from 2010.
2010, that's right. While earning her bachelor's degree in home economics from Cornell University, Brothers developed an interest in psychology, so she was a home economics expert. At Columbia, she studied psychology, earning a master's degree in 1950, and a doctorate 3 years later. She wrote her dissertation on anxiety, avoidance, and escape behavior. Well, TV is a great place for anxiety, avoidance, and escape behavior.
Yeah, that's exactly where you go.
Check out the IMDb. She has a long library of TV shows and game shows. Match Game. I was trying to find some Match Game audio.
Oh, that would have been great.
Well, again, there's some topics on there that we're just going to try to avoid here in Flashback Twin Cities.
Sure.
And remember, our number here is 651-275-1220. You can follow us on Twitter, TC Media Now. And some of the video and audio we'll be talking about today can be found on tcmedianow.com. So we have a good guest today. Good friend of mine, Johnny Canton. You might remember his voice from WDGY, WCCO-FM, WLTE, Bowling for Dollars, Bolorama. many other titles. Feel free.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. Thank you for inviting me and being your guest.
Well, I'm looking at your lovely partner, girlfriend Janie, brought this book in. I'm just looking at your resume here and all the stations you were at before Minneapolis. We assume we've adopted you into Minneapolis. Now, you're not going to leave us now for a different city, right?
No. I've been here a long time, since 66, November of 66, as a matter of fact. And many of the stations you're looking at, several were owned by one company. So
sure.
It was a matter of not moving around so much, but transferring among the properties owned by either one man or a company.
Similar to today. Similar to four stations being owned
yes.
in the conglomerate world we are today.
Yes, indeed.
Let's talk a little bit about the early days. What you grew up in Missouri, correct?
Missouri. Mm-hmm.
And you decided you wanted to get into radio, or how did this whole career start?
Well, it goes back a ways. I was born in Kansas City, and then we lived in the suburbs of Kansas City. And I was about 13 years old. And I, up until that point, I wanted to be a teacher, school teacher. And then one very warm Missouri night in July, my parents and I would drive around because we didn't have air conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
And it really would get hot down there in that time of the year. So one evening I said, why don't we stop by this little radio station down there, which I used to listen to, KOKO. And so we stopped in, and it was so warm, the announcer could not maintain his window air conditioner.
Wow.
Because it would make too much noise. So he had all the doors open, so you could literally walk into this small little radio station. And we stood in the newsroom area, and I was looking into the window, and watching this announcer, and this something happened, an epiphany, you know. It's like, that's what I want to do.
This is my calling.
And yeah, and we walked out, and I told my dad, I said, this is it. I'm gonna become on the air.
And did your dad say, what are you thinking? What are you talking
I'm sure
about?
in his mind, he probably thought, yeah, sure, and you know, and I'm going to become president of the United States. but I did. I pursued it, and I used to go out to that little radio station because we lived in Warrensburg, Missouri, is the mm-hmm. town I'm talking about. And I collected all the old commercials that they threw away, the written commercials, and all the news copy I could take away. That was when news came over a news wire.
I can appreciate that.
Ripped and took it home and read it and had my own little radio station at home. So that's where it started.
And where are those early tapes? Now, we got to find those and put those on.
I could not afford a tape recorder, so it was all in the air.
Okay. So you actually ended up working at KOKO.
I did later, yeah. I was going to high school, and right after my junior year in high school, I was 16, and I was pounding on the door of this other little radio station in a town called Lexington, Missouri, which isn't that far mm-hmm. from where we lived and Warrensburg. And I couldn't really get the ear, pardon the expression, of the general manager, because he thought I was way too young to work
right.
at the station. But as it would happen, in April, mid-April of 1958, they had a problem with their part-time weekend man, a problem that resulted in his being fired, and they had no one in the wings. And the program director of this radio station was my friend. He was really my mentor and friend, and he was pushing the general manager, mm-hmm. Ralph Metter, to hire me. But Ralph consistently said no until this one weekend when they were shorthanded. So Ralph called, Kermit is the program director's name. He says, well, let's give John a chance. So Kermit got a hold of me, and I went on the air May 8th, which is not that far back, you know.
Celebration.
1958.
I wasn't going to get the years, but since we've entered that, we can kind of go through the years here.
Yeah, I'm not shy.
Okay, I appreciate that. So you were not trained by a broadcasting school. You were
not
trained
at that time. I trained myself. Like I said, it was like almost at least 2.5 years of rehearsing in my room, in my parents' house, where I would have a daily show after school. And go through disc jockey work and read news and commercials. And ultimately, I got a tape recorder, a great big old thing that, you know.
Reel to reel.
Yeah, reel to reel. And so I did capture some things, but they've since been gone.
That's what Tom studied. When Tom is a recent Brown graduate. I think that's how he was doing studying here the last few months.
Studying that. I wasn't doing it as much as you, which is probably why you're much better than I am. But, I had a question for you, and now I can't remember it. Oh.
You'll think of it.
When you started recording yourself for the first time, were you really shocked
at
how
shocked.
You sound?
Yeah, mm-hmm. To be honest. I remember the day and time. I had no money. We had no money. And the only money I was earning was as a stock boy in an old dime store. Remember dime stores? Like Woolworths
Ben
and
Franklin.
Mattingly.
Oh,
yeah,
sure.
Ben Franklin,
right.
You
mm-hmm.
got it. Mm-hmm. And so I saved up a little bit of money, and I found out that this gentleman wanted to sell this reel-to-reel tape recorder. And he had it at an electronic shop, and I went in, and I'd never heard myself at that point in time. And so I went in and test drove it, and then I played it back, and I was shocked. I didn't realize that I sounded like that.
You know, a lot of people who hear themselves for the first time, that's the only time they'll ever record themselves. They say, "I'm done.
Yeah,
that's it. I do not sound good."
It's a skill to be able to actually listen to yourself after recording and be able to be comfortable listening to yourself. It's a very uncomforting thing at first to hear yourself and think this is what people think I sound like.
I think it must take years to get used to it.
Well, yeah, I don't think you ever really get used to it. You know, it's just like people who are on television. You know, I don't think they're or in movies or they're not. Some people I've read, and you have too, I'm sure.
We'll never see their own work.
No. They make a movie and that's
I've
it.
Heard that,
they
yeah.
don't even want to see it. You know, that's amazing to me.
As long as they keep on getting paychecks,
that's
you know,
right.
jobs.
So you moved from, our guest today, Johnny Canton on Flashback Twin Cities. You moved from Missouri to Fort Collins, Colorado. Now that's a little bit of a culture shock.
Yeah.
Going from.
Well, let's go back to when I got the job in Lexington.
Oh, sure.
And then I was between junior and senior year in high school.
And how much were they paying you, just if you don't mind me asking?
$1 an hour.
I like it. Okay.
That was the minimum wage at
I
that
like
time,
okay.
And they had to pay you minimum because of the Federal Communications Commission. So anyway, I went on the air in May of 58, and then the following year was my senior year in high school. Well, you can imagine the status I had at this little Higginsville high school, and I'm on the air at a station that most people listened to because it had all the local news and the farm stuff. And so it was a breezy senior. I enjoyed
that
it.
That was a fantastic senior year.
Yeah. And then when I graduated in May of 59, then I immediately wanted to go to college. I wanted to get some college. And I didn't want to wait until the fall.
Right.
So I went over and enrolled at that time it was Central Missouri State College in Warrensburg, Missouri. And I enrolled. And then I walked right from there to the KOKO radio station. And I sat down with the general manager, and I had an audition tape. And I said, I'd like to work here if I could. And so I played to the tape. He listened to it, and he said, when can you start? So I was on the air there. And now listen to this schedule in Warrensburg. I went on the air at 7:30 in the morning to 12:30, 5 hours, morning drive and all that other stuff. Drove over to the college. And I had my classes stacked to where I'd get enough credits, and I went to school from 1 to 4.
Right.
Then I came back to the radio station, did 4:30 to 6. So I did morning and afternoon drive, and then Saturdays from 6 until 10 in the p.m., you know.
So that must have been a out-of-body experience that year.
I would have paid them, to be honest.
How did you actually manage the 4 to 6? I mean, you have to do preparation time and everything in order to do that.
It was tough. By the seat of your pants, actually, you know, while I'm sitting there. Actually, 4:30 to 6. But while I'm sitting there, I'm writing things down. I'm running to the news wire.
Well, I think this is an era of radio where it's not – I mean, I'm popping up the weather here on the computer here. You had to go physically walk it off the prompter machine.
Walk right out of a studio like this one into another room, which was closed door because the Associated Press machine or UPI, whichever one we had, was clicking and clacking. So you couldn't you know, you had to make some moves.
And you and I were talking a little bit before the show, and I'm looking at these photos from the early days in Missouri. You're dressed like you're going to prom every night.
Yeah, that's right.
You weren't able to go to work in shorts and a T-shirt. I
worked the weekends initially, so I could dress pretty.
Okay.
That was the one you're looking at as a studio shot, you know.
But DGY didn't let you dress casual, did they?
No. When I first got there in November of '66, they had a pretty self-imposed, but it was kind of a nice dress code. And in fact, we were all trying to outdo each other. It got to be that, you know, the program director, Scott Burton, and you probably remember that name. And he and I were good friends, and I was the music director. And he would come in well-dressed, and then I felt, well, I better try to outdo him. And then you had, trying to think of some of the names that were there. Well, George Young and Jim Dandy and
Donald
K. Martin was there a little bit later, but everybody dressed and we all looked pretty good.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that trip to Minnesota. We're going to take a break right now. We'll come back with Johnny Cadden on Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB Club 1220.
Yeah, get down. It's Gilbert O'Sullivan at 947 at WDGY. You know, most kids today are good kids. We want them to stay that way. After all, they're the only generation we've got. We just suggest you support the Boys Clubs of America. Help them help you. I remember to continue the dark and blue. Yeah? Got no money and don't want any. Just traveling around. Speaking of having money, there was a conversation between a wealthy man and a newspaper reporter. Now that you're a wealthy man, are you ever bothered by the friends you had when you were poor? Asked the reporter. And came the wealthy man's answer, I never had any friends when I was poor.
What a great voice that is.
Wow, that brings back a few memories.
WDGY 1968.
Yeah.
Hey, just have a caller, actually. Would like to talk to you.
Oh, really?
We have Scott here.
Scott, welcome to Flashback Twin Cities.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine. 20 years ago, after you did what you did and peeked in other people's studios and took the news copy and stuff, I did the same thing with you guys at WCCO-FM. There was a time you were on with Tim Russell and Carl John Lensgraf.
Oh, yeah.
And Linda Painovich, the great late Linda Painovich, did the news.
Mm-hmm.
And she gave me a news copy one time that I took over to KBEM at Vocational because I was learning how to do radio. And then I went to KFAI. And one of the stories, I'll never forget it, it was about the Jim Jones tragedy.
Mm.
That was bad.
Mm-hmm.
But it was still fun to watch you guys work.
Well, thank you very
much.
And you
in a little white shack in downtown Minneapolis.
Yes. Oh, boy.
Thank you for calling.
215
okay,
South 11th
care.
Street, I think it was. Yeah,
that's right.
Right across from the old Lumington Hotel.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you for the call. That audio from WDGY, that is great because I love what's it called when you do the voiceover of the record when you first play the first few seconds?
Oh, you're talking up the ramp.
That's it, exactly, the ramp.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
And now, did you rehearse those, or did those just kind of come, wing it and come naturally?
Yeah, I think you acquire an ear for that. And of course, you played the song so many times, you know that intro pretty good. So you kind of time what you're going to say to the length of time you have. And if there's some little beats in the midpoint, you can bring them right in, and you get used to it. It's kind of fun.
I think I've heard at broadcasting conventions they actually have competitions to try and get it as close to when the song starts up the ramp.
That's great. Let's talk a little bit about coming to Minneapolis, and I want to. You know, we can come back a couple of other stations, but you've been in Minneapolis for almost 47 years now.
Yeah, 47 years. This coming November, I guess.
When you came here to work at WDGY, did you think this was going to be another 2-year job, and you were going to work somewhere different after a while?
Well, I really didn't know. I always wanted to work for Storrs Broadcasting. Mm-hmm. At that time, they were a very, very large broadcasting company. They had six of the biggest top 40 radio stations in America. And one of the stations, literally, I grew up under the antenna, was WHB down in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were really the company I wanted to work for. So when I left Cleveland, I had an opportunity to come up here to WDGY, and I thought, well, gee, that's on my bucket list, even though we didn't have bucket lists then.
Sure,
but
sure.
I thought, I can't turn this one down. So I took the job, and I didn't know how long I was going to be here.
Mm-hmm.
When I arrived here, I was married and had a six-month-old daughter, and it was cold. It was November, and I had no idea what kind of cold I was in for, or winter I was in for.
You go from you get your job in broadcasting by being inspired by a hot summer night, and then you come to Minneapolis and you can't leave the house for 6 months. But that, in November of 1966, you come to WDGY, and WDGY was a rock station. It was.
Oh, yeah.
It's had a few different formats since then, and the call letters and the numbers have changed, but it was a rock station for the first 11 years you were there.
Yeah, and a very big one. You know,
Tell me a little bit about the WDGY days. I mean, tell me a little bit about when you first got there. What was the rock era at that point?
Well, we tried to imitate a very popular top 40 radio station at the time, KHJ out in Los Angeles, who was programmed by Bill Drake, who really set the broadcasting on its ear back in the mid 60s, and that's what we were trying to emulate really in. It was a very exciting radio station. We had a lot of promotions on the air, contests. Outside of the radio station, all of us on the air would play basketball against different faculties, different high schools in and around the area. So we were a very, very visible radio station public-wise.
And your main local rival, of course, was KDWB.
Yes. Yeah, very.
And what was the difference between DGY and KDWB, in your opinion, at that point?
Not that much. I never thought we both were playing basically the same songs. We had a little bit better coverage because WDGY was a 50,000-watt radio station, even though it was pretty structured where they broadcast that signal, but it was still covering this area very, very well. And KDWB had 5,000 watts.
I'm looking at a picture here, and I think that I need to point it out. I wish I could show this over the radio, but I can't. It's Johnny Cannon with the Beatles.
That was when I was in Cleveland. I was program director at that time, and we brought the Beatles in as a promotion for the radio station.
You brought the Beatles, and I love that. We just gave the Beatles a call, and they came in.
And that was and actually we shouldn't have had the Beatles, but I think Louisville had a contract with them for this date. It was in August, and but Louisville canceled for one reason or another, probably money, and so our management owners jumped on it and grabbed them up. But I remember one of our owners, Norman Wayne, was just nervous, because he had to come up with $75,000.
Oh, my goodness.
And that was the front money. I mean, that was, that was the only money. But they wanted it up front. Brian Epstein used to manage the Beatles. And
a pretty good manager.
Yeah. And but he grabbed it, and we didn't know, we didn't know how well they're going to go, and we rented the municipal stadium downtown Cleveland, which was the home of the baseball team, which is no longer. But that was quite a promotional trip that was.
Did you get a chance to actually talk to them?
Oh, like, yeah, sure.
Are they incredibly friendly?
There was a gentleman that called me, owned a mobile home dealership. And he said, hey, Johnny, he said, I know you got the Beatles coming in. Is there anything I can do? Maybe set up a trailer out on the, the field? And I said, well, yeah, that sounds good to me. So yeah. That's what he did. He configured a mobile home and delivered it, placed it at the second base area between actually the pitching mound and second base. That was going to be their green room. And so that worked out real well. And that's where those pictures were taken, and that's where we got together with them.
Other big pictures.
We had other acts too, by the way. The Ronettes were front acts. Bobby Hebb had a hit record at the time called Sunny. The Circle, Turn Down Day, and Red Rubber Ball, they were on the bill.
Oh, yeah,
and then, of course, we had a band for them, and the Beatles did their own music.
So was this work, or was this just a fun? This is yeah. just going to work and having a ball every day. This is,
yeah, that was fun.
Life could be
that was a fun radio station.
Life could be worse. I'm looking at your DGY photos here, and I'm looking at a picture with you and the Hubert Humphrey, Muriel Humphrey, George Seaton, the director of the movie
Airport.
Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about the movie Airport. I think people recall that it was filmed here in Minneapolis, and you played a. A gate agent, right?
Yes, a great big one-liner, but I didn't wind up on the cutting room floor, as they say. And you know what? I still get paid for that.
That's
because
fair.
It's still being aired, and because I was a member of AFTRA, with, mm-hmm. and they had a reciprocal deal with SAG.
So every time that show's on TV?
Well, yeah. Well, not every time, but over the course of the year, it'll do it. And I got to tell you something. I just got a check from them. And I don't know why, but it's the union SAG got a check from NBC Universal for $60.
Hey.
And the reason was it lists Murder, She Wrote / something else, the title of the segment. So the only reason I can believe I got it is because they use possibly a segment of that film within their show, one of their shows. But I didn't know about that because I was never on
Murder, She Wrote. You weren't suspect number one in a Jessica Fletcher murder? That's unfortunate.
Of course, it could have been a mistake, too, but that's okay. Keep them coming.
I'm looking at the scene here, and this is great because we have we had Johnny at the gate, and then all of a sudden a frantic Johnny pointing. And it's a great movie if you haven't seen it yet. Again, our guest is Johnny.
Well, think about that. That was we filmed that in 1969. And it was released in 70 and became a big movie.
Big hit. And I'm guessing for a couple of years, you might have said, hey, I was in Airport. You
yeah,
know
yeah. yeah, I milked it, believe me.
Oh, why not? Looking at some more people, Tom Jones, picture of Johnny Cannon, Tom Jones, the Osmonds.
That was a big night over in St. Paul. Yeah.
With the Osmonds. Let's talk about
that. Osmond Brothers and boy. What a crowd they had, and it was just exhilarating to be at the podium or the stage, and every time you said a word, you know, a great big applause.
And you emceed a lot of concerts at First Ave, which was not called First Ave; it was called Uncle Sam's, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or was it called something else?
No,
before?
The Depot.
Oh, the Depot, correct.
The Depot when it first opened.
Because you emceed the Sonny and Cher concert when it came here, correct?
Right, and actually, she did not. Show up. In fact, we almost fell on our noses with that one because Sonny and Cher was pregnant,
mm-hmm.
and it was like a week before they were to appear. And this was a part of the Minneapolis Aquatennial, and WDGY had the big main show at the old, I think, Minneapolis Auditorium downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And Sonny calls me and said, "You know, I won't be able to come in and do your show." And I said, "What?" and Cher was having a problem with her
bread.
Pregnancy. So I went through my whole list of people who were trying to get another act to replace. But how do you replace Sonny and Cher at that time? That was 1968, I think.
This is the I Got You Babe era.
The beat goes on. Mm-hmm. You know, they were big TV mm-hmm. television show. So it was like 2 days before, and I called Sonny at home, and I asked him. I said, he was a very accessible guy, by the way, nice guy, and I said, you know, we're really over the barrel here. We don't have an act, and we're going to be, you know, wind up with eggs on our faces
right.
if we don't. So he said, well, I'll check with her doctor, and then I'll get back to you. So he did, and he called me back, and he said, well, she feels comfortable, and that I could be out there. So he came out. And what we did was I put him on the air during the day before the show. And I said, let's make a little fun out of this. And I said, why don't we invite some of the female singers, Cher wannabes, to come down to the auditorium, sign up in advance, and they'll sing with Sonny.
Oh,
and so we had about
great.
10 of them. And they're teenagers, and it just turned up, and the crowd went crazy.
Was part of you thinking, and then I have a Cher backup in case Cher needs to leave to go back to home. I have a Cher backup waiting for me. Our guest Johnny Canton of WLTE most recently, and let's just talk a little bit about the year 1977 because WDGY became country.
Yes.
What's the deal with that? Why did what?
Well, I don't know.
Because you were a program director at that point, correct?
Right, and then I. But the manager and I parted company, and I basically decided maybe it's time to get out of the broadcasting business. So I joined a friend of mine who owned an advertising agency, and I became his executive vice president, and I was kind of relegated just to kind of go that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun. But then I got a phone call from,
CCOFM, correct?
Yes, but this before that, I ran into some people at KSTP TV, and Tom Ryther was leaving, so he suggested I take over and take over Bowling for Dollars. So that's when I did Bowling for Dollars in November of 77.
And Bowling for Dollars, if in case people don't remember, that was a show that you would get called on, or you'd come down to the bowling alley about 7 in the morning on a Sunday morning, correct? And
yeah.
Then you'd get your name picked, and you would go ahead and roll for cash and prizes. Let's listen to Bowling for Dollars from 1978.
It's time to hit the jackpot on Bowling for Dollars, the Twin Cities Big Money and Big Prize game show, where everyone's a winner. And now for all the fun and excitement, here's the man with all the dollars and all the prizes, the kingpin himself, Johnny Canton.
Well, hello, good evening, and welcome to another session of Bowling for Dollars on Channel 5. I'm Johnny Canton, and we have a whole collection of bowlers here. They're going to strike it rich and win some money and some prizes and all that kind of stuff. Here's how we do it. 2 strikes to win our jackpot. Then our bowler will go on and roll that 3rd strike. And if they do that right, they're going to win a beautiful KitchenAid Superba dishwasher.
A dishwasher.
Which features the soak and scrub cycle that's sure to get the dirtiest pots clean. It's the top of the line, Superba. It's presented by your local KitchenAid dealer. 4 strikes in a row. Wins for our bowler the Omega Constellation watch. It's all handcrafted in either stainless steel or 14-karat gold with a mineral crystal. It's a beautiful watch from Omega. We have bonus ball prizes. We have a red pin drawing at the end of the show. And for everyone who bowls a strike or a spare, a generous supply of Palm Beach hair care products. But let's get it rolling. Get those strikes rolling.
I get tons of emails on Bowling for Dollars, people asking, do you have my video of Bowling for Dollars, the one they were on 35 years ago? Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of Bowling for Dollars tapes that exist.
No, I don't either.
It's, and you gave me that one, which I have on tcmedianow.com, which you can go and log into anytime and see Johnny Canton host the whole show. Did you ever have a 4-strike bowler on your year you did it?
I don't know. To be honest, I can't remember. No, that was rather a tough show to do, to be honest, because we were at a bowling center, and we did 4 shows in a row. Those were 30-minute shows, and the way the set was, they put that set out on the bowling lane, mm-hmm. the approach, and then they had, I think, 2 or 3 cameras way back up there behind the audience,
right,
and no prompters, and there was a lot to remember. So in front of me, I had voluminous numbers of notes.
What bowling alley was that at? What bowling alley did you?
That's a good question, too. Oh, Diamond Lake South, the old Diamond Lake South, owned by a good friend of mine, Jim Madden.
And did you like bowling, or was this just a job?
Yeah, that was my first job in life, was a pin setter in the old bowling center in Missouri or Kansas.
Well, I recommend people go check it out just to see that fantastic mustache.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was probably trying to make a statement of some kind at that time.
Yeah, that's a good statement. So you jumped back into radio then not long after
yes,
this.
Yes, Bowling for Dollars, and that was a great time slot, 6:30 primetime access.
2-3 nights a week, right?
Yeah, and the time I was doing it was on Thursday night. But it got me a lot of exposure. And Paul Jacobson, who was managing WCCO-FM at the time, obviously saw it, and he called me up one day and he said, would you like to go back on the radio? We need part-time work. And he said, let's get together. So I did, and bingo.
33 years at CCO-FM with a little short break.
Yeah.
What shifts were you just doing? Whatever shifts they had for you, because you'd gone from pretty much kind of running the show at DGY, and now you're a part of that. Been a little bit of adjustment to go into a radio station and again, and then be, you know, just do shifts as needed. And
right, it was basically Saturday and Sunday, and then vacation coverage or illness. But it was great. I just loved it. And during the summer, most of those people who were working there, Paul Stagg and Tim Russell and some of those other personalities, had been there so long they had a vacation, a lot of vacation. So during the summer, I'd work 7 days a week.
Well, and FM radio was new. I mean, it had been around since the 40s, but actually making it a commercial station and actually making money out of FM, that was a novel thing for the 70s.
Exactly, and they were very popular. If you remember CCO-FM when it first started, it was alternative kind of music, nice music, but not any top 40. KS95, I think, had had that ball game for a while.
Yeah, they were what were called a hot AC station, and CCO was a little bit more, I guess, called adult contemporary, which hadn't evolved as a genre at that point, but
it
kind of was a forerunner. Let's take a break. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about the CCO FM and Light FM days with Johnny Catton on KLBB Club 1220.
Barry Manilow at CCO FM. I'm Johnny Cannon on a Sunday, a couple minutes now before 4 o'clock. Curly Haywood won the 24 Hours of Daytona for the fourth time today with help from Danny Anjay and Ted Field. Ferrari, driven by John Morton and Tony Edmonds, finished second. News coming up. It's 4 o'clock. Good afternoon. This is WCCO-FM, Minneapolis-St. Paul. Johnny Cannon with news from our CCO-FM News Bureau. Nicola Larson on a Sunday afternoon at WCCO-FM. Going to take a lot of love. 10 minutes after 4 o'clock, Mesa Kincaid a little bit later this afternoon to keep you company on a Sunday early afternoon and late evening. This is Chicago right now. Wishing you were here.
CCO FM 1979.
Oh, weekend. Weren't we mellow?
Very mellow, very calming.
A lot of love. Ooh, that was nice.
I'm looking at the John Denver autobiography cover here, and I just want to read this little caption that's on his book here. Through the summer, the song got into the national bloodstream. It first aired in Minneapolis, where Annie and I were still living. I had taken the record around to a very hot disc jockey named Johnny Catton at station WDGY, who liked the song and gave it tremendous airplay. After that, word of mouth moved it. The same thing happened from city to city.
Yeah, that was very nice of him to include me in his book.
A very hot disc jockey named Johnny Catton.
Yeah,
I like
right.
That.
Well, I know him pretty well. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were friends, and I met him at Nancy and Bill Carlson's apartment one night, and we were going out to I think it was the Guthrie to see Chris Christopherson.
Mm-hmm.
And so we met at Nancy and Bill's place for a couple of adult beverages before we went to the theater. And then and John, now keep in mind, this was before he became a superstar. He was still living off of his notoriety with Leaving It on Jet Plane, which he wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter, Paul, and Mary had successfully recorded it. And he was with that Chad Mitchell trio for, if you remember, but he was looking to become a big singer, a superstar, and he told me at that time, he said, I've got a new album coming out on RCA that I'd like to have you hear, and it was Poems, Prayers, and Promises, and I said sure. So we got together for lunch over at a restaurant near WDGY over in Bloomington, and I said, well, John, why don't you come back to the radio station, and I'll put you on the air, and we'll interview you, and which we never did, But he was a local gentleman and had a lot of big following here, so I thought that'd be kind of fun. So that's what we did, and I played Take Me Home Country Roads from the album. And he said, that's going to be the single. I said, well, okay, well, good luck, and when it comes out, let me know, and maybe we'll give it a spin or two.
And you must miss him greatly.
I do. It was shocking the way he passed, but, he was quite a guy. I knew Annie pretty well, too, and had an occasion to go out to their. Her parents had a home out in Prior Lake, and they had a party once, and we all went out there, and they were just a great couple. They were in New York once, and I had I had planned a party where we lived, mm-hmm. and had several people coming over, and I asked John if he would want to attend, and he says, "Well, I'm coming back from New York," but he said, "Yes, we'll be there." And so he did, and unbeknownst to me at the time, he had put together RCA, and he put together this real nice gold record.
Oh, sure.
Honoring me for being the first to play Take Me Home, Country Roads, and making it a big hit and all that.
Is that hanging in the office right now? Is that hanging up?
It was.
Okay.
But
okay.
I still have it, so it was kind of nice.
Now, and the best part about this, now think about this, Tom, over there in the booth there. Johnny Canton's nicking all these phone calls to people, and they're answering the phone. I mean, we have to email and text each other to be able to get something happening within a week. Johnny Canton calls someone on the phone, they answer, they're at his house.
Yeah.
You know what? I think you should just make your ringtone on your on your cell phone. Sonny called me up.
Sonny Bono
and Cher called
brought
me
the
up.
Beatles in. Right. John Denver came over for a party. I'm looking at a picture of Wayne Newton here. We have Engelbert Humperdinck. These are some great photos from the Light FM days, because you had a lot of artists come in to the Light FM
to do
promotions. A letter from Hubert Humphrey, just a brief note to say hello again.
Yeah. He was, boy, what a mind that man had.
That is, so let's talk a little bit about so CCOFM turned into what's called Light FM. We had someone we were talking with before the show started asking, I didn't know CCO had an FM. Well, you probably listened to it. It was 102.9. The same owners just changed the call letters in the mid-80s.
Right. It was, they changed it. They went through WCCO-FM to FM 103,
mm-hmm.
still being WCCO-FM. Then they changed their call letters, I think in January of 84, to WLTE, which became Light.
Mm-hmm.
And they used W Light a lot. And then I left in June of 84, came back in September of 85, a year later.
Did they call you and beg you to come back, or what happened?
Yeah, well, no, they didn't beg. I think we just kept in touch and
beg's the wrong word. Yeah. Encourage you to come back.
Yeah.
There you go.
Encourage sounds good.
I guess the coincidental part, this is the second time in your life that a station went country on you toward the end of your stint there.
WDGY went through a little change before I left. They went to Y11. I don't know if you remember
mm-hmm.
that, but that was kind of Steve Miller Band all the time type music.
It was the KQRS model of music.
Exactly.
They're trying to emulate. And when you change your format, your audience goes away.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, yeah. And I think the same thing, WLTE, they changed their trying to do a different business format. And I know a lot of people have asked me, what happened to LTE? What happened to Johnny Canton? And it just
it was somewhat of a shock, to be honest. I don't think many of us knew what was coming down. That was Christmas time of 2011, and it was. It didn't have too much of an impact on me because at that time I was back to part time,
mm-hmm.
and with the technology the way it is, I used to go in on a Friday night, and they had to pay you a certain number of dollars hours,
mm-hmm.
Because of the union contracts, and so I would go in at 7 o'clock on a Friday. I could tape 9 hours. Of my weekend show in an hour and 10 minutes with a computer, and all I did would be the voice breaks. But you could hear the last song, the end of the last song, then you come in and do your talk and then start your next element, and you could do that.
But how can Tom and I request our favorite songs on Saturday if you're voice tracking on a Friday night?
Yeah.
That had been a different change of radio than you were used to. Did you like doing radio that way?
I didn't mind it because
time is more efficient that way.
It's efficient. I did have some extra work to do, of course. Mm-hmm. After an hour and a half, they weren't just going to pay me to sit there. So I did what they call production. You guys know all about that, where you dub commercials and do commercials and take care of all that stuff. And so that took up another 2-3 hours. But one night a week. But there some other people worked at the radio station that had a bigger impact, the full-time, who had been there for years. And I felt really bad for them because it came as really a shock.
It was a heritage station that had been around for a generation. Either it's Light FM incarnation or the CCO FM incarnation. There's some names that have been around for 30 years, including yourself, that were gone.
Yeah. Paul Geiger had been there for 20-some-odd years.
Kelly Ryan. A lot of people remember Early Knutson in the morning, and you retired a few years prior to that.
Right.
But that's a name that a lot of people remember.
From your experience, when people do change over their radio station formats, have you noticed that it always happens? Like, overnight, people just had no idea?
Right.
Or are people kind of aware, you know, at least a couple weeks ahead of time?
Yeah, I don't know why they do it. I'm sure they have a reason, but it happens. It happens a lot.
Yeah.
Well, do you miss the radio business right now? Do you miss going in and doing it?
You know, I thought I would miss it a lot more than I ultimately found out I didn't miss it. I do get a chance to go in once in a while to the studios and do a commercial for a client. And so that kind of keeps me in touch. But, you know, the radio, when I was at WDGY and Wixie in Cleveland, another top 40 radio station, and Light FM for a while, it was fun. It was fun to be on the air. You had, you had things going on, a lot of promotions.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden it became such a money-oriented business driven by advertising and ratings that kind of the fun lost itself. Plus, you have to admit, radio has changed a great deal,
and
all the entire entertainment
business
has changed because we have everything else.
Let's listen to some more LTE.
For more information, call 612-373-3333. Metro Transit. Hop on.
Twin Cities West.
Well, according to Channel 4 meteorologist Paul Douglas, afternoon mostly sunny and windy, 55 today, partly cloudy tonight, 30 tomorrow, mostly cloudy, 53. Sunshine in the Twin Cities now, 52 degrees, as we welcome you to our Facts Back Playback Lunch Hour, WLTE. It's brought to you by Metabolite, the slow and safe and sane way to lose weight. I'm Johnny Canton. This is your opportunity to be our Adwork Music Director.
That's what everyone remembers, that great voice on midday lunch. And
what did you do? Did you enhance that some way?
No, that is straight from a audio air check, actually from radiotapes.com. I encourage you, if you like to listen to some of these old air checks, go to radiotapes.com. Well, are you going to go do some golfing this weekend, hopefully, if it warms up?
Well, tomorrow we were looking at it, but we don't know.
Okay.
You play that by ear.
So when they ask, what do you do nowadays? Golfing, enjoying life?
In the warm weather season, I golf quite a bit, and then I bowl a lot.
Dollars?
Yeah, not quite.
Okay.
But I bowl 4 times a week on various leagues, and I enjoy that. And, of course, I keep in mind, I was a bowler when I first, my first job was a pin setter, and that, of course, got me into bowling. And I had to be a fast, what, 10, 11 years old?
It gives us assurance that the Coast of Bowling for Dollars had some credibility hosting the show. Johnny, thanks for coming in today, and we'll have you back again, because this is great talking about this. There's so many more pictures and stories we need to share someday, and we'll get to do that again.
Well, this has been a very fast hour, and I certainly appreciate it. It's been my privilege to be here.
Johnny Canton, my guest, Flashback Twin Cities. We'll be back next Saturday here on KLDB Club 1220.